go for the 89th episode of We Talk Comics on the air and in your ear, as we always are. Hey, everybody, I'm Mo. I also got with me Brett.
Hello.
Chris.
Hey, I'm here. I got you a few places.
Are we not doing one of those, like, you come up with a topic and we have to say something things this week?
Well, we are. You see, I'll say, because there's four of us, I thought we would now do a barbershop quartet thing where I go, hello, hello. So I'll do it. I'll do it first. I'll go, hello, Brett.
Hello.
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 That was not very tight. One more time. This time, I'm trying to bring it in together. Everybody together. Everybody, find your inner barber. Hello.
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 Well, Keith is still awful, but everybody else, good job. Welcome to We Talk
Comics.
You started an octave that leaves me no room, Mo.
Oh, okay, I'm supposed to start. Okay, one more time. All right. I started off really deep this time. Hello.
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 Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Now follow that.
Yo.
So,
all right.
The 89th episode of We Talk Comics is called Everything and Nothing, because that's what we're going to cover in this week. We got some craziness happening. We're going to be talking about a movie that was sent to us by the film's producer called Who Else Doesn't. We're going to be doing a little bit of news. We got a whole bunch of Wii views to come up and a great interview that Keith conducted while he's at C2E2 with Mansentori Griffith. And they talked to Greg Capullo and Scott Snyder, Canadian.
I was not at C2E2.
What the hell were you at? Right.
Wizard World Comic Convention, which is an entirely different event.
Yes. You were looking for wizards.
Yes, I was at a wizard convention.
Somebody could have mentioned that to me before I put up last week's talk up.
Yeah, I changed the image that you put on our website when I saw that you had put up for the round show.
Oh, did you change the rest?
Was it in the text as well?
Yes.
If it was in the text, I did not.
Alrighty.
I just...
You know what? It is really seriously Chicago's fault for having more than one convention. Those assholes.
Right. Well, we'll be at the Calgary Expo in September, which is held at Red and White Club.
That's right.
That's not a comic show.
We'll be looking for expos. Let's see if we can find some former Montreal expos while we're there. All right. Well.
Just think of Keith's news really out of date.
At this point, I'm actually going to leave it as the faux pas because it's funny. At this point, why fix it? So anyways, it doesn't matter. You're still with Scott Snyder, Canadian, and Greg Capullo. So that was great.
Canadian treasure.
Canadian treasure.
And Greg Capullo, not Canadian treasure.
But a treasure, nonetheless.
Yeah.
So... All right, and we'll warn everybody now. Interview will contain F-bombs, correct?
Greg Capullo contains all the F-bombs.
Sounds awesome. All right, let's get on to the weekly news with Cover Porter K.
All right, the news, well, it continues to be August, so news is a bit thin this week. We just skipped right past it a couple of weeks ago, but in all the craziness, August 2nd, 2011 was the inaugural episode of We Talk Comics. So we're just past our second anniversary. This week is the second anniversary of when I became regular co-host instead of guesting. Memories.
It was all downhill from there. Yeah.
That's right. Look, when that opens as the biggest news story of the week.
You wouldn't believe how small the news gets after this. You wouldn't believe how much smaller the news gets after this.
I can't believe that was only leading off our news. Why did not lead off? Why didn't August 11th CNN lead off their news day? Fox News, all this stuff.
And it certainly didn't appear on Comicosity, so...
Phil Jimenez
about next year's C2E2.
Phil Jimenez will be working on a Transformers book coming up. In November, he will be working on the comic book event Transformers Dark Cybertron.
Who was that?
Phil Jimenez.
Okay.
Wow.
He will be doing covers and layouts for this book from IDW.
That's interesting that the words Transformers and comic book event would be in the same sentence now.
Can we have them cross over with Kiss?
Yes, I'm sure we can.
Hey, let's talk about something we never talked about here that happened a couple months ago, because I want to get everybody's opinion on this. This is months ago now, but what the hell? Michael Bay doing a TMNT movie. Megan Fox in it as April O'Neil. Anybody? Anybody got anything to say on that?
TMNT movie.
What's that?
You lost me as soon as you said turtles. It's a good place for him. Two things I don't like put together. Michael Bay and turtles.
You don't like
it's
the
like
turtles?
It's like a containment unit.
How can you not like the turtles?
I like the turtles matter, in the comic book.
I'm perfectly happy. Turtles I have the animated show. I don't need anything else.
I actually don't care for the turtles either. I never really liked the comic either. So,
but don't you think Michael Bay will make a movie that sucks? Can we at least agree on that?
Yeah.
He'll
make a movie where the camera slowly revolves around the turtles while it rises. And then there'll also be a scene where the turtles are standing and the camera is down and to the right, so they're looking slightly up at them. And the sun's coming up behind them.
Oh, yeah. There
will be lens flares. There'll be explosions that they walk away from without looking back. So all of the good stuff. It'll make $180 billion, and we'll all wonder who went to it.
So what you're saying is you're his cinematographer.
No, he's not that well paid. Keith, I mean.
All right. Anyways, all I know is that was announced months ago, and our crack news team did not report it. Let's go on.
We're not typically.
Decided the news editorial team decided it was not newsworthy.
Decided it was
they
Michael
Bay. They would have
Bay.
Actually been right.
Are the Turtles an actual comic thing anymore, or have they evolved past that? I stopped paying attention years ago.
You're probably right that they're when people think of the root of the characters and what this will be based on, it will be based on that animated show, which was not very much based on the comic book. So as it first appeared. So you're probably right. It's really not even a comic book property in many ways at this point.
Yeah, but they still have the comics.
The comics,
yeah, they do.
Yeah, it was published. Is it IDW?
It is IDW, movie? Yep. And they have the animated series comic as well. So, I mean, and the animated series is popular and very good. So,
the current one?
The current one, I love it. I think it's amazing.
The current one's good, Brett?
Yep, my favorite.
Interesting. All right. All right, let's move on. What else we got in the news here as I try and draw it out for us?
Man of Steel Blu-ray comes out in November. 4 hours of extras. And there's a super duper special edition that comes in a Superman S shield case.
It gave me a chubby, despite the fact I really didn't like the movie, but the case is awesome. The
packaging is really cool in this one.
Yeah. Too bad it comes in packaging. If they could make that case really, really cool and be in my house and be digital, I'd be happy.
Well, I've got a photo I could just email you.
Yeah.
That's kind of that's what you want.
Done deal. Wow.
I'll tell you what, Mo. You buy the box. I will buy the box from you, and you can keep the movie.
I'll never watch the movie, Chris.
There's a digital download code in it, so if you wanna go halvesies on the set and just take the digital download, it works for me.
And the picture. Yeah, see, there you go.
I can email you the picture now just gratis. That's on
all right,
me.
What else is going on?
And we're seeing the end of Avengers Arena. Avengers Arena will end here in in, it looks like, November, with issue 18. It will be transitioning into something else that they have not announced yet.
Is there any indication that it's sales-driven, this cancellation, or is it story-driven, which is quite a possibility?
It looks like it's sales-driven, but they always had an end point in mind.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that series is always rocked. I love that series. So
The final arc is titled Boss Level, playing with the game.
All that said, it's pretty. When a series is transitioning into another series that probably picks up 1 month later, it's not really canceled. They're just repackaging because I think it's fairly good and hope that a fresh coat of paint will get people to actually read it. That's what they're doing.
Well, it did a nice job with the Superior Spider-Man team-up versus from Avenging Spider-Man, so...
Yeah, I could see that exactly. That's exactly what they're trying to do. And that makes sense.
And we're hearing rumors, as yet unconfirmed, that that Venom will end in November. And the November or December issue will be the final one, which is unfortunate because for 1 month, Venom was going to be the highest numbered mainstream book at Marvel or DC.
Didn't we take odds on how long that would last?
Yeah, and I think whoever said it would last about a month is likely to win this one. I think the next bets are on if any book from Marvel or DC will hit number 50 again.
50 seems possible. 100, I think, is really pushing it. I'm not sure we'll ever see a 100 again. Pardon me?
100 seems so far away. Even double shipping, it seems so far away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean 50. I mean, we're at, what, 23 of, that came out today of, like, Animal Man or stuff like that. Like, wasn't it a 23rd issue?
23, yeah. DC has only been doing 11 issues a year because they've been doing the events in September.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's not like Detective Comics. I see... be canceled by issue 50 or anything, but will it go that long before they reset it again? You know, another, will it last 9 years to be a 100, you know, get to issue 100? I just don't see that happening.
And that's
just
the news.
I just want 50 again before we start counting on hundreds.
Well, we'll get to 50. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, two and a half years from now, you'll be at number 50 on, you know, Action Comics and all that stuff. I mean, there's no question about that. Marvel, I'm not sure. Will we get to 50s on those? Yeah, I mean, the way Superior Spider-Man is going, we'll probably have that sometime next week.
I do wonder if at some point they're just going to skip to the old magazine numberings of, they'll call it season 2, number 1.
Could be.
And relaunch them all. Like they could relaunch. I could see one of the two of them trying that first, to just do everything as a 20 issue limited series.
Could be. What's Savage Dragon on now? Like,
wow, it's
180 or something.
190,
like,
I think it was.
Got to be close to 200. I mean, they've now transitioned that it's not the main dragon character anymore. It's his son, because his son is old enough in real time.
But I think
to be the lead character in the book.
Spawn 188 issues, 4 readers.
Yeah, but would it be the highest published, like the most published issues now? Highest counting anything?
I think Spawn is higher.
Spawn is over 220.
Is it? Okay.
I'm opening up the top 300 here and looking for triple digit numbers.
You won't find that many, that's for sure. But
X Factor, which is just about to end.
Yeah.
Spawn 233, Journey into Mystery, which is just about to end.
Yeah, Journey into Mystery definitely had the highest numbers.
That doesn't really count, though.
Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog is the highest number one I see at issue 251 coming out last month.
Hmm.
Okay. It looks like they ship twice a month. So,
well, yeah.
Current front runner, Archie, 645. Never a complaint about looking for a jump on point with Archie. I've never heard.
Yeah,
anyone.
Yeah, you know what? I never think of Archie as anybody reading the issues. I just think about people reading the double digests, which aren't numbered. I don't believe.
No, I think they are, but I'm pretty sure they're numbered with volumes and like volume 16, issue 12.
I I mean, I so rarely remember noticing numbers on, like, the comics at all.
Mm.
Yeah.
I assume they have
them. Yeah, and I don't really count that. So I would count Spawn as the real champion here. Yeah. And Savage Dragon is number two. And then what? Witchblade? Is that number three?
Witchblade won't be any close to that.
No? Well, it's at like 175 or something, isn't it?
Well, we've got G.I. Joe. 168.
Okay.
And
168. Okay.
G.I. Joe 192 because it picked up the numbering from the original series. Simpsons 204. Simpsons at 204.
I would count that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you pick up the numbering from the original series and you're off for a decade, I don't count that. That's not continuous.
Yeah, I mean, Journey into Mystery, which is I don't count that. Would have had eight. What about eight different titles that combined into that number?
Yeah, because what is it, 650 something?
640, yeah. It's 646, I think it was when I looked at it there. But it's combining numbers from Thor, Journey into Mystery, like two or three volumes of Thor.
Yeah.
I don't count that. Yeah.
Also, it's
all right, so what else is going on?
That
is interesting, though. I do think that's an interesting... What a discussion. I'm glad we talked about
that. I'm going to enjoy the 1 month where Venom is the highest numbered comic. That's all.
I'm just curious, who's writing Venom nowadays? Who's writing Colin Venom Bunn. Now?
Okay. Colin Bunn.
And Fearless Defenders is still running.
For now.
Give it another couple of months.
Kind of, I think it's on life support.
That also has four readers, and we know all four of them.
Yeah, that's right.
This week also brought the last issue of Legion of Superheroes. September will be the first time in 12 years or something that there's a month without a Legion of Superheroes issue. A couple of months off between the three boot.
And you know, you hear all those people crying about it. Oh, wait.
Well, I do hear people crying about it. I'm not positive they were buying the book. But they are lamenting its loss. Like so many things that get canceled, there are more people lamenting the loss than there were actually purchasing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was one that didn't quite work. In the New 52, I mean, it's a challenging thing overall to have a book that's set in a different time. We've also just seen the end of Demon Knights. So the two books that were taking place in a different time period just wrapped up.
And who was writing that one again?
Legion?
Yeah.
Paul Levitz.
That's what I thought. So, I mean, if he wanted to have made a executive decision and kept it going just to satisfy his own ego, he probably could have.
Well,
he doesn't hold that position anymore.
Yeah, but he still has power.
I don't know. At some point there's overhead. I mean, you got to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
I mean, the financial model on a Marvel or DC book involves collections. It involves digital. It involves keeping the property active. So there's a lot of complicated math, but at some point, I mean, you can't just throw money out the window. And Legion of Superheroes is not it's already failed as a cartoon. It's not likely to get picked up as a property, and if it is, you'll want to relaunch it anyway.
If Guardians of the Galaxy can be a property, a film property, so can Legion of Superheroes. End of story.
Yes, but Marvel's scraping the bottom of the barrel. They're looking for anything to make into a movie.
Yeah.
Do you see, they're going what not to make out of the movie because they haven't made anything.
That's true. They're like, people really want to see that Flash movie. Let's not do it just to screw with them. Let's do another TV series again, as the rumor was that they're working on.
Well, it's not a rumor. They are working on a TV series, but they do really good on TV.
Perhaps, but you know what? They're taking Flash and they're not doing. They do really good on TV. Well, it seems to me like the last Batman and Superman movies did pretty well too. I mean, they're taking this property. Isn't it true that is it a spinoff of Green Arrow, or is it just done in the style of it, or?
No, it'll be a spin-off.
Yeah. That screws the movie property. Well, I guess it doesn't necessarily, but
well, they could just end run the whole game and connect Arrow into the Man of Steel universe.
Or you can just do it as a separate property and not even tie them in.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'd be a little surprised if they tied the TV stuff in, but if S.H.I.E.L.D. is a hit, I could see them doing it within a year. I mean, they're not going to do it unless S.H.I.E.L.D. is a huge hit.
Now, just speaking of Arrow, how do you feel about the announced Canary fiasco that Diana Lance is not going to be the Canary in Arrow? You're fine with it? Okay. Yeah.
I'm gonna guess because you called it a fiasco that you have a differing opinion.
Well,
I have no idea what the hell you guys are talking about, so maybe you can explain it to people before you go on.
Diana Lance in the Arrow television series is the love interest to Arrow, but they have announced they are introducing Black Canary, and it's not going to be Diana Lance. It's going to be a new character called the Black Canary. I just can't imagine the Black Canary being anyone else but...
Wasn't the Black Canary originally Diana Lance's mother?
Yeah, I Black Canary's comics? Origins are strange and mysterious. There's been a couple different versions.
I'm going to just say two things. One, Dinah. On the show, is it Dinah Laurel Lance or Laurel Dinah Lance? She goes by Laurel on the show anyway. I don't know. I'm fine with it. I think that when they started the show, that was kind of the subtext that maybe they'll put her in a costume later. Maybe it's just to have that dynamic. But as that character's developed, I don't think she should be in a costume. I think that character has gone a different direction. I think it's an interesting idea to then mix up the expectations.
And couldn't this person still be her mother?
They've introduced that character.
And then she becomes her down the road? No,
that character's mother's been on the show.
Okay. Well, either way, doesn't it mean that this person become a villain and becomes the Black Canary or a hero or whatever, and it flames out and she dies and she picks up the mantle and next year she's it? Like, is anything permanent?
What do you call the evil version of Black Canary? Dark Black Canary?
Dark Black... dark.
Slutty
doppelganger canary.
White Canary?
White Canary.
I don't know. I'm curious if they're going to break their no superpowers rule. That was the conceit of the first season, was that there was no superpowers, but now they've...
Why do they have to do that?
That was just what they decided, because they wanted to separate the movie.
Why do they have to break that rule?
Well, they're introducing Black Canary. They haven't said if she has powers. But they're introducing at least Barry Allen. Whether he'll have Flash powers in Arrow or not is a question mark. So I don't know yet. They haven't said if anyone's going
to
have powers.
Flash would be really hard to do without superpowers. Black Canary is possible.
It's just a guy that rushes. I mean, if he's
exactly.
He's just got good reflexes.
He's really quick. Usain Bolt will play him. No, yeah, exactly. I mean, Flash needs superpowers. Black Canary doesn't need superpowers. It's not like you read the Grell run and her superpowers are in your face all the time.
No, I mean, Grell didn't use the powers.
He didn't at all.
He didn't want to use them. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't see that being an issue. I mean, I think Grell had, Hal Jordan show up as Hal Jordan in like one issue? But never actually had Green Lantern or showed powers.
Yeah, that was what Grell wanted to play with, was that he didn't have any powered characters in the book.
Yeah.
And no trick arrows and
all that bullshit, yeah.
Stupid trick arrows.
Oh, come on. The boxing club arrow is a classic. I love it. It's stupid, I know, but yeah, I have to put it in every late 10 issues just to say it still exists, because it's fun.
Anybody else? Let's take a vote right now. The other two guys here. This is the point in the podcast where we agree to mute Chris's mic. Everybody.
Did the Golden Age Green Arrow have funny arrows, or was it just standard arrows? I don't remember.
No, he had funny arrows. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so he was first to. Well, I thought he was before Hawkeye for Trick Arrows, but I wasn't sure.
I'm pretty sure he is. I'm not 100% sure by any stretch, but.
Well, perhaps both of our listeners could do some research.
That's right.
come up with this. All right, that's still the news.
Both of them? What the hell are you talking about? How about our several thousand listeners can tell us? Not that we ever hear from any of you guys, but we do appreciate you listening. All right. What the hell were we doing?
I dream of you.
So who is Delson?
Delson. Who is Delson?
Look it up on IMD. It's just called Delson. This is a film that was sent to us by the producer, by the Guzzo brothers, Paul Guzzo.
Yep.
Paul Guzzo was the. Is he the one who sent it to you, Brian?
He is, in fact.
Yeah. And he's the director, and his brother Pete is the writer of this film. And they sent us a copy. I know it has a 1.9 on IMDb, but it also only has 10 people that has voted. So if you're looking for it there for information or whatever, you won't really get any. So let's talk about this film. Brett, like I said, it was sent to you. So why don't you open up here telling everybody kind of what's going on, why it was sent to us, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I never know why anything's sent to us, but in this case, I'll assume it's because of the comic book reference. I can read the little plot summary.
And our thousands, nay,
hundreds of thousands of listeners, but...
Brett, don't be stupid.
I'll read the plot summary.
Millions.
Dozens.
Millions.
Dozens of listeners.
Tens of millions. But
listeners not even yet born. The listeners who will be hearing this decades hence,
yes.
Looking back
but
on
anyways,
the glory
back,
days.
But
anyways,
back to our thousands
the time
of listeners.
Capsule.
Thank you very much to our thousands of listeners. Brett, go on.
All right, I'll read the plot summary that came in the email and on the box. It was one of the bloodiest crimes in the history of Tampa, Florida. In July 2009... Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gerard Martinez walked into a Tampa Bay museum with a gun and killed 10 people, men, women, and children, before turning the gun on himself. In the days leading up to the murders, he was making a documentary on what had become his obsession, proving the existence of Mon Protecteur, a mythical French superhero. This documentary uses his footage, police evidence, and interviews with his friends, family, colleagues, historians, and others, to paint a clear picture of the obsession that drove Martinez to the edge and to try to figure out if Martinez actually found the mythical hero or if he simply found a con man. There it is. And he was kind enough to send us the movie because he's trying to get a real grassroots campaign going and he needs reviews. So we were there.
All right. So Brett, having said that, What did you expect when you put the film in, and what did you think once you started watching it?
Well, one of the reasons that I definitely wanted it on our list was because I saw that Lloyd Kaufman was in it, and we all love Lloyd Kaufman. You know, there's no question.
Hurrah!
And so that gives it a little bit of cred. Now, I guess at the same time, it's one of those cases where When you see comic book movie or comic book and you see Lloyd Kaufman and stuff like that, you just have expectations of what it's going to be like. And this movie was not like that to me. It definitely was not. It wasn't a blood and guts trauma type thing. It wasn't really a comic book style movie. It was far more along the lines of the Blair Witch Project, I guess, and it does have Greg Hale, who produced the Blair Witch Project, in it as well. And, I mean, so ultimately, it kind of fell down that whole found footage, mock documentary kind of thing, and I guess I wasn't really expecting that overall. So, you know, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, I'll leave that up to other people.
No, Brett. The whole point of discussing the movie is you're allowed to say if that was a good thing or bad thing on your opinion.
Well, I mean, I think it was probably a good thing because it was different. it was not where I would have expected the story to go. And that's probably a good thing. The, you know, the bad elements are come in some of the, there's technical flaws in the movie, which annoyed me, you know, being an editor and such. Like, I notice when dissolves aren't in the right place. I notice when text screens aren't up for long enough or are up for too long. I notice when you could probably cut about 15 minutes of excess footage out of the movie and have a tighter movie.
Well, actually, that's an interesting point I never thought about. Your editing experience probably brought up some things I didn't notice. I will agree, I did notice there was certainly a couple scenes where they were trying to establish the personality of the character, the main character, but they went on too long, and that was usually very much in the beginning. And so for me, it happened a couple times later too, but especially in the beginning, I thought it took me a while to get into the film. The same thing is, I didn't know nothing about it except for you had brought it up to me a few months ago, and then you're like, oh, I finally got it. I'm like, oh, cool. And you're like, yeah. So I'm like, why are we watching this again? He said, well, it's got Lloyd Kaufman in it. I was like, great, Lloyd Kaufman. So I sit down for a trauma-like experience, as Chris figured he was going to get to earlier this day. Having watched it before him, I tried to warn him, this is not a trauma-like experience at all. And that took me quite a while to get over. You hear Lloyd Kaufman, you're expecting that trauma. This is as far from being... This is a very, very solemn, somber, serious movie. Though Lloyd Kaufman being in it, if you do get to his points, he's only in it for a little bit, but freaking hilarious still. Like, he says some stuff that's just freaking hilarious. But as a general rule, this is a very, very morbid, morose film in some ways. And that caught me off guard. I mean, it's unsettling, I think, is what they're... is you know, I mean, obviously when you talk about somebody opens up the film and somebody, you know, breaking down to the point where he goes and shoots a bunch of people in a museum and then turns the gun on himself, especially in light of real world tragedies made after that happened after this film that have been like that, it's kind of unsettling. Chris, what did you think?
Well, the filmmakers did make a film for me. This is the type of thing I actually really usually like a lot. And unfortunately, fortunately, I can forgive a lot of the budgetary problems with the movie. And as Brett mentioned, the crossfade editing needs some work. I can even forgive the god-awful two-note soundtrack they have playing through the entire thing.
Also by one of the brothers.
Not to mention the first 40 minutes of this movie are talking freaking heads. So I've watched movies like this and I want to like movies like this because they're trying something new. Unfortunately, the bleakness of this movie saps all the joy out of it for me. Really, you wonder if anyone ever in this movie other than Lloyd Kaufman ever smiled. The joy was gone. Plus, when we do see images of Mont Protector throughout the first half of the movie in comic book form, there's never been a comic book published successfully with that bad of art. Every image of Mont
Well, it only had four issues, was part of the...
Yeah, it wasn't published.
It wasn't a successful series at all. That was part of the
point. No, but the... okay, there was the comic book series, and then they do go on to elaborate that there are other images of Montactor in history, and they do show those images, and they're all obviously drawn by the same artist that did the comic book. It lost some believability there. Also, with the talking heads, at no point did I ever get the sense that they weren't all speaking with one voice. The interviews all blended too well together. I'd expect some differing opinions between the talking heads, but really all the talking heads were making the same.
Chris. No, there's definitely some
not enough. I wanted some argument. They fade back and forth in between different people talking, and it was like one person dropped a sentence, the other one picked it up.
No. That was very much the beginning. That was in the first 20 minutes. But once you start getting into the backstory of who the character may actually be and start talking the religious elements and these different elements, you would have somebody bring up something from the comic book world, and you'd have somebody bring up something from the religious world, and they would conflict, and you had these different points of views and these different things. And that was one of the things that this film, like I say, didn't start off strong for me. It took me a while to get into it. But it does reward you if you stick with it, because it has some interesting twists and turns, and it does become more of an interesting, like, he's taken real world mythologies and his fake mythology that he's created them and blended them to the point where they're almost seamless. And some people will watch this and seriously think that this was real, or at least that this is a real, not realizing, because it's presented as a documentary, not realizing that it's all a work of fiction. And but the way that they blended some and researched some real world mythologies and blended it into this fake mythology so seamlessly made it feel like a real documentary, and that's where they were successful. And there were definitely some differing opinions there,
because some of these people, you have to remember, Chris, the entire movie.
No, Chris, you have to remember, not everybody in this film was an actor. So when you were sitting there listening to some
apparent actually,
when you were no, that's not that way. Some of the acting wasn't good, and some of it was good, but some of the people playing the actors, I agree the actors generally did have the same voice, but because you had people who were actually experts on a mythology or experts on these different areas who weren't acting, were now actually talking from their real world points of view, and that was spliced into it, they mixed it up and gave different voices, I felt. Brett or Keith, we haven't heard from you yet. I don't think you finished the film, did you?
I couldn't make it through it, and some of the things that Chris has brought up are the reasons. I did find a lot of the characters just sounded the same.
Yeah.
And it's the challenge of anyone writing a script is to just give each person an individual voice. And I did feel it.
Well, some of that's on the sounded, actor as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think there is that one cop that has a completely different voice, but my biggest problem with him was actually the fact that his different voice was almost pushed too far across the line. So it was.
Well, I'll tell you where
added
I'll tell you
to
where,
the
where
fact he was the worst
about.
Actor in the bunch.
True.
I'll tell you where the first where it really bothered me. There's a point where his sister reads his graduation speech as valedictorian. Oh,
yeah,
and then the professor reads his book that he wrote, and it's the exact same tone and words, and that was where it was really apparent what you guys were talking about. Like I say, I almost turned it off here too. Like, I had to get past that stuff. I'm glad I did, but I could see how it totally would turn you off.
The thing that bugged me actually about the graduation speech was not the text of it and not really how she was reading it. It's that she had the entire thing memorized,
yeah,
which just seems so unnatural.
I mean,
you could expect that she would know a paragraph, but I mean, it's not like it was the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah, he's talking about the greatest generation, and it goes on a long time.
It goes a long, long time without her ever having, like, it would make sense for the character to have a piece of paper in that case. The other thing that I found really, really challenging with the film was, it felt like about six different films worth of raw footage that they were using to pad out that first half. Particularly this stuff about the Highway of Death in Kuwait. The Highway of Death is 18 years before the event, before the shooting in this film. So I kept getting confused about how old this guy was.
He's immortal. He's been around like 3,000 years. If you had walked, you would have got that.
No.
The reporter.
The reporter.
Won a Pulitzer Prize for being on the Highway of Death in 1991.
Yeah.
And yet does not look 50 years old when he does the shooting.
He did have the gray beard, so.
Yeah, I mean,
I think the attempt was there to establish him as older, but no, I mean, he didn't have old age makeup or anything like that, for sure.
No, he looks like he's late 30s, and they're trying to present him as 50.
And it really seemed like the purpose of using the Highway of Death, which they went to great lengths to explain, was to make a point about the Highway of Death being a war crime, not because it actually served the story and not because it served the character in any way. Because they spent a lot of time on that.
Like, actually, it did. Like, if you, again, probably not as well as they meant it to, but it did serve the story and mainly the character as it moves on. As the further you get into it and you kind of, because, I mean, the thing is, you're trying to realize what this film never gives you is whether or not this character, Delson, is actually immortal and a superhero or not. Or is he crazy? Or is he a con man? And the same thing, like, you never get an answer, but that's how they try to present it. But one of the reasons why you see him go down into his craziness and do the shootings does tie back to this stuff and does tie back to these events and it does get there, but probably not with the skill that they wanted it to.
I do believe that there was some repetition. There was extraneous footage that they included, and I think if they had excised some of that, then it probably would have been a little bit tighter, moved a little bit faster, and gotten where they wanted to go little better.
It was a 97-minute movie that would have been served well to be 85.
Yeah, I agree with that. In that regard, you know, one of the other things that I'll say about it is that I love Stephen Bauer. I thought that he was really cool as an actor that they were thinking of to play Mon Protector in a movie. I loved Lloyd Kaufman in there. I loved Greg Hale, you know, as the Blair Witch producer.
Who was the guy who was the comic book expert that was sitting there with the shirt with the Fantastic Four? Human Torch.
I think that was comic book guy from The Simpsons, wasn't it?
Well, and no, this is great. Well, but this is what I wanted to talk about was that he was the comic book conspiracy theory guy.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, that's one thing. But I was actually thinking that to add that extra comic book cred to the movie, it would have been really interesting to have. Because, I mean, you talk about having these other guys that they have in there. It would have been really interesting to have a guy like Mark Evanier in there, who is actually a comic book historian. I mean, and then have him talk about Mon Protector. And I think it would have helped ground that in the comic book world even more.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Brett. I don't get the feeling that these guys ever left the state of Florida to do this any shoot anything.
No, I'm sure they did.
And I think, you know, I'm pretty sure Vanier lives in California.
But, you know, he travels on, you know.
I suppose.
I mean, style-wise, everything looked the same. It was that one piece of news footage, and I think if they had a bit more of that, it might have. I've watched a lot of found footage movies. I actually enjoy the genre, and faux documentary. A bit more mix of that. I mean, would have helped it. It would have helped that suspension of disbelief. It all looks.
I have to say the news bits did look awesome.
Yep, the news bits look very realistic, and like I say, some of the footage, like he has a camera on his tie that he's using later, and so there was some different looks again as you move on, and it goes more into the found footage and less into the talking heads, because it does switch from a movie that is like a documentary talking head style film, a news report type film, into being more of a found footage documentary as it moves on. I think it was really brave, like I say, the way that they took these characters and the way I'm really glad we got to watch this. I enjoyed this quite a bit. I liked the film a lot because I think it's very brave that you gave us a film without all the easy answers. And it is the opening is showing, you know, his horrific actions. The ending is the events where it actually happens, and leading right up to it, you know, because you've already seen the beginning, that it's going to end badly, but you're still cheering for him and you're still, you feel bad for it. It's a horrific event, and you know it's going to end wrong and end horribly. But it was unsettling, and emotionally it really connected to me. Also, there's a scene where he first meets Delson Mon Protector in his farmhouse, where he's confronting him, and then he sneaks into this barn area, and you know that the Mon Protector is going to come back and going to see him, and you don't know exactly what's going to happen. I found great tension in this scene. Like, I thought this was a really well-crafted scene. I was really into it, on the edge of my seat. So, like, I think it's a very brave film. It's got its flaws, but I commend them for making it. Chris, I think you disagree with that. I'm just kind of seeing you.
Well, I think the whole crux of it actually lies on if you actually can relate to the main character, which I suffered a disconnect. I thought he was a little douchey. I didn't feel for him at all.
He wants to save the world, Chris.
Yeah. But he's doing it for selfish reasons, in my opinion, at least. He's trying to justify his own viewpoint of the world. I don't believe the world's going to blow up any day now. I don't think the world's an awful place. They didn't sell that to me. I just didn't feel for him. Thus, the ending of the movie was fairly meaningless to me.
How about for those innocent people shot? Don't you feel something for them?
Yeah, well, I thought that was actually kind of tasteless given the light of recent events. But
yeah, but this would have been filmed before that.
This was filmed before, so I can't credit for. But emotionally, it was just icky. I will say a movie filmed in this style for The Toxic Avenger I'd watch and have fun with.
Did you see the post credit? Did you watch all the way to the end, the credit?
I did enjoy that. Yeah,
the credit at the end is another Lloyd Kaufman comment. Did you see it?
No,
I didn't. Did he have Mom Protector join the Avengers?
No, well, basically he's sitting there and he's like, well, we have been talking, me and a good friend of mine who's a Hollywood producer, a successful one, not like me, you know, I just kind of do my little cult movie things there, but we think about doing a real big monster, not me though, because somebody that had actually watched the film is what you want here, so you don't want me directing it, but a big budget Mom Protector film, and it's pretty hilarious.
Well, because he was talking about bringing out a comic book as well with his buddy of 40 years, Stan Lee.
Stan Lee, yeah.
So it was cute. It was funny.
Yeah. Brett, I think you should get the final thoughts on all this since you brought this to us. An interesting discussion. Certainly, I think this film, I mean, know what you're getting into, which we didn't, but if it interests you, do check it out.
Well, and I think that's just it. You know, I applaud them for making the movie. I think that they made some really interesting choices. You don't see it very often that you have a big chunk of the movie that has a terrible audio, really. But it was a style. It was a conscious decision.
Yeah, it actually said on there. It would actually say there on the bottom, like camera in camera. What was it like? Camera in tie. Poor audio.
Yeah.
Like it was a style choice to have it to make it more realistic to give it bad audio.
Yeah, and I mean I appreciate those elements. I do think that as a whole, the entire movie felt a little slow and a little too long. I definitely think that could be fixed without much issue, just like some of the technical difficulties. I think that the movie's I think it's a solid movie. I do.
All right. Interesting. So thank you very much to the Guzzo brothers. Guzzo.
Guzzo. Or ZZO.
To me, that's Guzzo.
Well, we'd need to have one have somebody clarify that.
But thank you very much for sending us the film. A little fanboy film review from a different perspective this week, Keith. You saw your interview at C2 Wizards World. Capullo and Snyder.
Now, the part of the text of this interview appeared on Comicosity. This interview was recorded by my pal Matt Centauri Griffith, and I got to sit down with Greg Capullo and Scott Snyder to talk about Batman, specifically talking about Zero Year.
Guys, thanks so much for taking the time. It's a huge pleasure. You're really like the key collaborative team in the industry right now.
For the architects and the men, thank you.
Yeah, right. you've been working together for almost 2 years now. like, how do you think your ideas about Batman have changed in that time? And have you sort of influenced each other at all?
I mean, I don't think our idea of Batman has changed at all. I mean, we feel the way we feel about him. I mean, we're getting to portray a different Batman now in Zero Year because he was immature and still learning the ropes and learning how to control himself. So in that way, at the moment, we're seeing Batman in a different way. But as far as our relationship, I mean, I think it's always evolving. You know, we're getting tighter and more. I think it would make his job easier and because he gives more to me to do, and then it makes my job easier because he lets me. You know what I mean? So we're getting better at working as a team. We're already pretty good at it, but I mean, all relationships grow together, and so I feel we're evolving in a positive direction, and hopefully the fans, you know, feel the same when they see the work, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I couldn't be prouder. I mean, I of the stuff we're doing now, I feel like it's our best stuff. We were just saying, I look back at issue one or issue two, I'm still really proud of it, but it's like, it's hard, because I feel like we're just getting started now, where it's like, Greg has become one of my best friends, like, outside of comics, and somebody I, you know, has been a real mentor to me, both in the industry, and, you know, just gives good advice to me outside of comics as well. And, no, seriously, all the time. And so, I mean, it's a pleasure to get to work together, because I feel like, we were just saying, someone asked us in an interview, like, he asked, like, what comics most inspire you, and there are a lot, you know, that I really pick up to try and be a better writer, but the comic that you should be most inspired by, I feel like, is your own, and the way of being, like, I get his pages, and it makes me learn to write better, you know, because I'm like, wow, I love this comic, you know, and that's the way it is working with him for me. I mean, there's nobody in the world I prefer working with him ever, you know, and it's a blast.
His check's now in the mail.
Yeah.
No, it's huge.
Man, I'm going to get broke between a guy in front of me right now.
So, what was your motivation behind, like, going back in time and telling Batman's origin right now, the Zero Year?
Well, my feeling was, like, I guess we were finishing the Joker story, and Dan DiDio and DC started sort of talking to me about this idea that I had pitched them for an earlier story that was sort of part of what Zero Year was. And they kept saying, you know, there's no origin anymore, and I didn't really understand, so I was like, no, we kept Year One. But then they pointed out that, you know, Jim Gordon has a different origin, and Barbara Gordon has a different origin, and James Jr. would be 5 years old, and all that stuff, none of it fits anymore. Selina Kyle has a different origin. So they were like, you don't understand, like, Batman's the only character, pretty much, who has not had his origin explained in the 52. We got Action Comics explained, Superman's, Wonder Woman explains, Wonder Woman's. So you got to do it, or, you know, don't do it, but we need something there for somebody. And I was like, well, nobody's doing it but us, so you don't even start with that. So I realized that the story I was thinking of, which was this big, epic kind of Year One story, could incorporate as Year One instead of kind of Year Two. And then, in fact, it would make more sense that way. So I decided, all right, if we're going to do it, I tried to keep a couple pieces of Year One to begin with, and I was like, that's just stupid, because it's just, I'm going to write them and they're going to be like paler versions of that. So I had this real epiphany moment before we started, where it was like, no, we got to do it our way, make every beat our own and different, and know that Year One is a masterpiece and will always be there for people, and, you know, you might not be able to touch it. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be able to try and do something special of your own, you know, now. And so that's what this really is. It's meant to be Batman if he grew up in the modern world today. Different fears. I mean, I grew up in the 80s in New York, so it was prostitution in Times Square and drugs and gangs and the subways and the Central Park dangers, and that was all in that book. But that's not what New York is, and not what cities are like nowadays. Your bigger fears are about the giant, terrifying violence that comes in the middle of nowhere, and guns, you know, random violence. And so I wanted to create threats in the Red Hood gang that represented that, and to bring Batman up as though, what if Batman formed right now? What does he mean? All of that stuff. And so I'm really proud of it as a kind of colorful, almost punk rock kind of origin now, where it's totally opposite of what you'd expect, where it's bright colors, fast-paced, odd construction, you know, really big and bombastic, not dark and gritty, and secretly there are all those layers to it beneath the surface. So that's the whole impetus of it, is it's really everything we have we're putting into the story.
Well, it's really interesting, too, because the first thing I noticed about the art from, you know, all the previous long arcs, is that it was daylight and so bright and happening. You know, not everything else is always happening at night, and frankly, on almost every block.
Right, right.
So it's
that sucks if you're me. Right, because shadows. Well, first thing, shadow defines form, and it gives a lot of weight. So when everything's bright, you know, it takes some of that weight away from it a little bit. But everything's also exposed, right? So, you know, you have to draw the shit out of everything. You know, oh, that's not lost in shadow. It's out in bright daylight. So, yeah, it's a little more labor intensive when everything's out like that. So, but, you know, it's all right. It's all good because it's really serving the story. And as Scott said, it's making it dramatically different. You know what I mean? So visually, it's different. It sounds different. So, because that's what we want. You know, we keep talking about, you know, year one and everything like that. But, you know, I keep saying it, man. Don't compare it to year one. It's not year one. It's something different than year one. Judge it on its own merits. A different thing. And you can love both equally. Hopefully you love ours. You might hate it, but I think you'll love it. And but just forget about year one in context of 0 year. Just separate them if you can in your mind and enjoy this for what it is. This is just a different era. It's just like, you know, going, but I love Pong. Well, Pong is fucking awesome, but now we got asteroids. I'm dating myself. But my point is, you can have two very cool things, you know, that you like, that you're fond of both. So, yeah, ours is going to look different. Ours is going to sound different, look different, everything about it. And so hopefully you guys are loving it as much as we love doing it. We are pouring our guts into this. I talk to Scott, sometimes losing his fucking mind. You know, he's going, oh, my God, you know, I'm on all this pressure. I'm rewriting this fucking line. And he got me erasing one fucking panel of the face, you know, six times. What the fuck? First fucking five times. It was great. But but I wanted the head to out position at this point in the frame, you know, and at that angle. Were you out of your mind? Yes, I'm out of my mind. You know, so anyway, we're getting both a little kooky about it. But hopefully, though, that means when the fans get it, they're getting the very best thing we could do in the time that we have to produce this stuff, and that they feel the passion that we're pouring into it, because we are both very passionate about what we're doing together, and we really, really care about the reader and giving them his money's worth. $4 is not cheap for a comic book. You want them to go, wow, best $4 I spent. You know what I mean? So Scott and I, we're pedal to metal. Like I said, we're cranking it up to 11. Yeah, that's right, it goes to 11. And we're going to just try and blow everybody's hair off so they look like me.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because I think in comparison to a lot of Batman origin stories, I mean, Bruce seems to some degree a lot more immature or maybe even just a little more impatient. But it's very much on the surface. And so seeing that development has been really interesting.
Thanks.
How do you sort of make that leap from the way he is today backwards?
You remember, you're youth, right? That's what you got to do, right? You have it all together at age 17 or whatever. No, it's a progression, right? I had a bad temper, you know, and quick to fight. You know what I mean? I'm not that way anymore. You know, I learned self-restraint. I know I jumped ahead of you, Scott, sorry.
No,
but I'm going, you know, in your youth, you don't have it together. You know what I mean? That's something that gets developed over time, you know? And so you figure, you know, with what Bruce has been through, he's got all this pent-up aggression, and, you know, your testosterone levels are higher in your youth, too. You know what I mean? So that adds to the aggression. And so, you know what I mean? He's uncontrolled. So, I mean, to me, it's just natural. If you can recall, you know, what it was like when you were a younger person, then it becomes an easier way to write something like that, I would imagine. It would be for me, I mean, you know.
That's it. I mean, it really is. It's like, for me, I feel like in a lot of the origin stuff, you see Bruce relatively well-adjusted. Not well-adjusted, but knowing he needs to become Batman. Like, that, knowing that he needs to become something. And I wanted to do something where the thing that he becomes means nothing at the time, where he's a vigilante hiding in the shadows and Bruce Wayne is legally dead. He doesn't want to bring it back and he's essentially a ghost. And to have that, have Alfred and have, you know, his allies, or really Alfred, say to him, you have to mean something. Like, you can't, that's the legacy of your parents, is that they fought for the city publicly. That doesn't mean that Bruce Wayne has to be X, Y, or Z, or you can't be Batman, but it means you have to inspire people somehow. And if you don't, you're not worth anything doing what you're doing. You can fight forever. And so I needed him to be somebody who was thought he was fighting a guerrilla war. It was totally like a kid thinks that he's not only invulnerable, but he's always right. That's it. He's like, you don't know what you're talking about. I know. I've been on all alone for 7 years. This is the way I need to do this. And I really wanted to draw that up in a big, really aggressive way from him.
I mean, look at man. Albert had us just bitch slap him. Yeah. I mean, right?
I love that title.
Grow up, you son of a bitch.
It seems much more of an adventure. Like he doesn't seem the dark brooding. And now it's time. It's Wednesday, and Wednesday's the day I said I was gonna start fighting crime. It seems to me much more like figuring it out.
Yeah, well, that's part of the idea. Is the point of the whole first arc is he has to learn to mean something, and that doesn't necessarily demand that it's that same dark, gritty, corrupt city feeling of year one, where it's kind of like, how do I, you know, this city is rotting and I must. It's not that. It's more like there is a huge, epically giant villain in this Red Hood gang infecting and taking over the entire city, symbolically. And I need to be big. I need to go big or go home. I need to stand up and matter to the whole city now and figure out a way of doing that. And that happens in the daylight. It happens to Bruce. It happens to Batman. So we want it to look and feel like that. Like, it's not some really dark, brooding story. It's really, it's got those layers. I mean, it's got layers and it's got symbolism and all the things that we like to put into all of our stuff. But it's meant to be kinetic and bright and for young readers as well as readers our age to say, wow, that's what Bruce would be like now. You know, if he was figuring it out, he was 24 or 25. That's the Batmobile he'd use. That's the suit he'd wear. That's the way he'd look without the cowl. All of that's different. Like, everything you're going to see radically fun, different gear and all of it. Like, it's supposed to look like stuff you would use today.
Well, and you mentioned symbolism. I thought one of the most interesting parts of the last issue was the Ouroboros page that the Riddler takes Bruce through. Like, what was sort of the thought process that went into developing that?
Well, I'll tell you what. Scott is a studious son of a bitch, because here's how it started. You know, he sends me the script, and it goes, you know, maybe we do something cool, you know? Because, you know, once you do something that everybody's noticed, you know, like issue five, you, like, grab a lot of attention, you know? You kind of, like, have it, like, we got to do something cool again somehow, you know? And so Scott was saying, hey, maybe we do something cool like that. And he goes, maybe, you know, like a crossword puzzle page. We do a crossword puzzle. And I look at that, and I went, and I'm trying to plug it together with Riddler, you know? And so I went, maybe puzzle pieces instead. So then I sent him all these sketches, maybe do puzzle pieces, you know? But even when I said that, I go, that's still not it, you know? And this research hound goes and digs up this Egyptian board game that they don't know how it was used. Now we know how it was used. It was used to draw Batman stuff. But, it was actually perfect. Why that stuff didn't fit as well is it had nothing to do with the Egyptian theme that you were right there immersed in, right? And so Scott finds that game board, and then you go, bingo, perfect. The only concern there, but we already conquered issue five, was the reader might get a little bit lost going around that wheel, but just collectively said, fuck them. They'll figure it out, right? They're not a bunch of dumbasses. They're smart. They're reading our book. So, anyway, that's how it came out, by him doing his homework, right? I'd have never found that. I'm too busy to do homework.
And the board, the fun thing was, they don't know how it was used, but they think it might be, you know, one of the precursors to the Ouroboros, and Grant has done such a great job with the Ouroboros, I thought it would be a nice nod to use that word, Ouroboros, in there, even though in itself it's just kind of a strange construction.
Well, and so, you know, so bringing in the Riddler, bringing in, at this point in his career, the Red Hood gang, I mean, they seem really sort of old school gangster as opposed to what Gotham becomes, which is this, you know, I mean, with characteristically freak show or whatnot. I mean, how do you feel like that sort of parallels Bruce's journey as well? Is it literal one for one, or is it sort of...
No, I mean, I feel like the city, what Gotham is, and this is something that we tried to do in a couple stories to touch on, but here it's touched on really centrally, is that Gotham is great because when you go to Gotham, and he says it in issue 24, Bruce has a speech, actually, I'm really proud of. He talks about this. That's our... Sorry. I don't know what I mean. How many hands have everybody shaken?
Right.
Anyway... The idea is that Gotham, you go to Gotham and you try and be a hero, and it's going to bring your worst fears to life, the form of all these rogues and villains. and terror tries to tear you down and say you can't do this. And all of us have that person inside that you know you want to be, that someone has told you I can't be, you can't be that. And the challenge of Gotham is it'll throw everything in your way, but if you can survive it, you'll be kind of burned down to that person you hope that you can be one day. And what I would say is that in that regard, with the Riddler and all of those characters, you see them becoming the villains that will be, and the city transforming into something that's going to be an enemy or an antagonist to Batman. So you watch them rise along with him, you know, to be his villains that will keep him on his toes all the time.
Will we be seeing more villains like that? Like
yeah.
The Riddler? Okay.
Yeah, you're going to see Poison Ivy in the second section. That's going to be a lot of fun. You're going to see a couple of villains I think no one is expecting to see. Very good.
Cool. And I know you've talked a little bit about, you know, your big Riddler story. Is that inside Zero Hour?
Riddler is the, Riddler's the big bad for the whole thing, man. Riddler's there for, he's the overarching antagonist. So this is you know, it's huge, a huge Riddler story.
All right. You know, and speaking of Gotham, you know, I wanted to ask, because she has meant a lot to a lot of people really quickly, with very few appearances. Harper Row, is any of her past going to figure into Zero Year, or where
she's
do you
not,
sort of...
Well, she's not in Zero Year. She has a brief cameo, I think, coming up in Zero Year, but she actually has a really big part in the story coming up right afterwards, and a really big part in a couple other books you're going to see, too. So her future in Gotham gets bigger and bigger after... towards the end of Zero Year now. So she's a character that means a lot to us, and you know, the biggest stuff with her is definitely coming.
And so, you know, maybe for Greg, how did you sort of, you know, come upon the look of her in particular? It's very unique.
Well, I mean, Scott kind of had an idea of what he wanted her to look like, so, you know, I was just trying to give right. Which I think you're on the fence about. And actually, I was corrected by person who actually has them. He's going, dude, the placement of that ring right there. No, they'd go through their septum. It's right at the point.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess I just never studied it that closely. But from now on, I will draw it correctly so that I haven't done anything harmful to her septum.
But anyway, it was that type of girl. And I mean, you know, big fan of girls. I notice every kind that's around me, you know. And so it was just a stereotype of the kind of girl he was after. And the nose ring thing just seemed like a normal thing that type of person might have. So, yeah, it's just, you know, he gives me the idea of what he's after, and I just try and bring that out. Like when we did the Court of Owls stuff with the talent, you know. Because, you know, sort of like G.I. Joe's Snake Eyes, you know. He sent me a picture of maybe a G.I. Joe character or whoever. And, you know, and we just talk about it, and I just try and come up with something visually that he's hoping I will come up with. And hopefully I hit the mark.
So you say that, but the other thing is that you make it, I mean, Greg makes it so expressive that he brings the characters to life immediately. Like, you know, I could tell him what Harper's supposed to look like, basically, but her personality came through in the very first couple of panels that she's there, where she's smirking with her eye here. Like, you know what I mean? That's the magic of what he does, in addition to his genius for, like, developing the visual depiction of the character as a design. He breathes life into them like that. I mean, like, when I saw Bruce, when we were first writing Bruce in issue 1 and 2, or Gordon, the characters come to life on the page because he gets how to emote panel to panel, you know, and that's really something that a lot of guys don't have at all.
See, when I was trying to get into comics, I was told a lot of great things by a lot of editors and, you know, artists and writers and stuff like that. Been in the business a long time, and I remember bringing in some samples of Thor and being told, you know, that's anybody flying around, it's not Thor. You know, Thor has a certain way of carrying himself, you know, and you have to feel what Thor is. You can't just draw a guy flying around, dress him up like Thor, and it'd be Thor. You know, so that was kind of like the genesis of my way of thinking when I go into character. So, you know, when I'm doing this stuff, you know, I'm trying to get into the psychology of that person, that who that person is. So when I'm posing a character, expressing Gordon or whoever, you know, it's like being an actor. You know, it's like playing the part. You have to play the role yourself. And that's what I actually do. And so
And that began with that guy telling me about, you know, that's just a generic guy flying who's dressed like Thor. That's not how Thor would fly. You know what I mean? So at the time, you're a kid, that kind of goes a little bit over your head, but now I get it. So I just follow that old lesson that I got when I was a kid trying to get into business and apply it now.
I remember when we did issue 20 and James called me up, Tynan. He was like, I'm so jealous. He just was looking at your two panels of Damien and that, when it's a flashback and the clay face. And he's like, because you see it and you're like, that's no other character ever but Damien, not because the way he's dressed, but his expression is on his face. You know, you really, he called up and he was like, I'm so jealous of you.
Well, I've had a few more years experience too.
I'm just like, good, you'll never get him.
So you mentioned growing up in New York and, you know, the 80s New York, which was, you know, that was Gotham City, and, you know, to Frank Miller, was the worst neighborhood in New York was the entire city. What's Gotham to you two?
Well, I mean, I think at its core, Gotham is what I was saying before, where it's an antagonist that transforms itself to almost look like, you know, the kind of fears of the person it's facing. So it's a wonderfully malleable place where you can set it in the Narrows, or you can set it in, you know, this decrepit area when you need it to be. But, so at its core, it's that. It's the greatest antagonist, but it wants you to win. You know, it's not like an evil place. It wants to challenge you so that you get through this trial by fire and become a better person. But it'll be evil to you in the way that it challenges you. In terms of what it looks like, I really love the idea that it's not a rotten, broken-down city the way New York looked in the 80s like that. I love the idea that it has these elements of wonder the way we draw it, you know, and bright, sort of sparkling towers. And at night, it can be terrifying. And it has both, you know, and that way that it has wonder and it has terror, and that's part of what Batman is. You know, he inspires people to feel like they can, he's this pinnacle of human achievement, right, where he's like the best detective and the best chemist and the best, impossibly good at everything, you know, and by punishing himself all the time that way. You see that and you're like, well, I can do what I need to do if that guy can be that crazy-ass thing up in the sky, right? So that's the wonder, and then you have the night, how terrifying he is to bad guys, you know, and that's, so that's Gotham to me both visually and what it stands for, you know, what it is beneath it, I guess.
And as far as me, you know, I just, it can't be a generic city, you know what I mean? If you're doing stuff, you know, for Marvel, everything's Manhattan, right? So it's not Metropolis. It's got its own, I look at it as another character in the book. You know, if I was drawing Spider-Man, I wouldn't be thinking of the city as a character. You know, so when I'm drawing Gotham City, I try and give it some kind of personality so you always know where you're at. It's like it's a living place for me.
So in every Batman origin, there's a chicken and egg question that you have to answer. You know, Gotham has a problem, and Bruce Wayne wants to solve this problem, but is there evil that makes these villains rise, or do they rise because Batman started fighting back?
Well, I really believe it's kind of what, I mean, for, look, everyone has their own interpretation. It's one of the funny things to be, I was on a panel yesterday that was like Batman and psychosis, and it was like, does Batman have PTSD, or does he have, you know, multiple personality disorder? And the funny thing is, like, maybe Grant's Batman has this, and my Batman has that. You know, they're very different. So what I would say in terms of that is that I know that for some people, Gotham is evil, and it is a place where the villains come first before Batman, or they come alongside him because they're part of his psychosis. But for me, the villains are extensions of his fears about himself. So Two-Face is kind of a mockery of the duality of his life. And the Joker is, you know, what if you fall into the madness instead of balance, you know? And all of those things are fears he has about his, himself and what he's doing. And the Penguin is sort of a fear of, you know, mocking him for not doing enough in his own class and being, you know, the people his parents were. And, you know, and in that way, I think that what Gotham, it's not so much that, like, he creates this virus. It's more that those villains are reflections of him in a way that Gotham is saying, now you're the hero, you're the Bat King, you're the, you know, the person, the greatest hero in the city. Here are your greatest fears come to life. Beat them, and you'll be the best hero ever. Go for it, you know, and that's kind of the way I see it, as a challenge that Gotham poses to you over and over again.
Is there a Bruce Wayne that isn't Batman. Is, you know, once he becomes Batman, you know, at the end, say at the end of Zero Year, he's got everything together. Is there ever a time he could stop being Batman after that?
No, I don't think he'll ever stop.
No, as a matter of fact, Frank Miller did the Dark Knight Returns, where he's like an old man that comes back. Ultimately, I think, Batman's End, it's going to be tragic no matter which way it goes. I'd like to write that, or do that story, you know what I mean? Which you can't do, I guess, right? Because the character can't go away. But either if he doesn't die in crime, I think the biggest tragedy of Bruce Wayne is, to be what he is, he sacrificed, his humanity in a way, right? To close his heart off from love, like the Beatles say, it's only a fool plays a fool by making his world a little colder. I think by the end, in the end game, because, maybe it's because I'm an older guy and I see how your perception changes, and the fire and the anger diminishes. At the end of this, when he looks back on the whole thing in retrospect, I'm sure he'll be proud of some of his achievements, but I think his heart will be filled with regret from some of the part of his life that he just shut the iron door down and didn't accept this part, this stuff into himself. I think it'd be a great story. I think he's a tragic figure. He's a successful figure because he overcame it. So it's tragedy, but in his life. But I think ultimately he's a tragic figure that will end tragically, no matter what way you slice it.
I agree. I think they're both on a mission. And that's one of the things we've tried to do differently than what came before, is that Bruce Wayne isn't a mask. Bruce Wayne is another. There's almost like three people, where it's like there's the Bruce Wayne that he is to the city, there's Batman, and then there's the private combination of the two that Alfred knows, And the Bruce Wayne he is to the city is he's, in ours at least, he's civically minded, out there trying to show that the city can be better, invested in it. He's not just like a foppish playboy. I don't like that stuff where he's like, oh, I'm out with two models, because I feel like that just does a disservice to what his parents did. I just don't believe it that deeply, honestly, that he would actually just make Bruce Wayne into a mask. That's embarrassing to his legacy, because his parents were public figures that fought for the city, and that's kind of a disgraceful thing. So I sort of shy away from that. I don't like that version of him. So I try and write him like responsible and more for it, like in Court of Owls, he's Gotham Initiative and all that stuff. But that's also a guy on a mission. Like, Batman's on a mission, Bruce is on a mission. What room does that leave for the third iteration, which is the actual private person who's the one that has kids or gets married or nothing? And that's the tragedy for me, is it's him and Alfred, and that's it. He has no life outside of being Bruce Wayne and Batman, and they both need to do X, Y, and Z. There's no room for love or for family or whatever, even if he tries to do it at the end. I agree. It's going to be a brutal end for him someday, but one that I think I can imagine him being there in the cave and being like okay with, even though it's going to be alone.
Yeah,
we gotta probably wrap it up, because we got one more, and then we gotta get to lunch.
Sure, sounds good. I've got one really quick question for Greg. So in issue number one, Breakout at Arkham, you got the whole Rogues Gallery. You show them off. There's a little puppet in the corner of the image. Is that Handy from The Tick?
Yes. No.
Finally solved. For copyright reasons, no, it's not.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you taking
pleasure.
The time.
Thank you for coming us.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all huge, huge fans.
Thanks.
You're doing just amazing, amazing work.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Keith. At least only one thing left to do this week. Gentlemen, a lot of books to review. First off, I just want to say, before we move on to the Wii Views, because we haven't actually done a Wii View section in a few weeks here, because we've had different style of... Have you guys read any number ones or anything new that you want to mention over the last little while?
Not me.
I don't remember anything that's come out, to be honest.
It's August. It's been really boring.
It's been a crazy couple of weeks.
Well, based on that.
I enjoyed After Houdini.
You enjoyed what?
And After Houdini, which is a Monkey Brain book. And also Sidekick was quite good. Did we ever read Sidekick?
No, we didn't read it for the reviews, obviously.
And I enjoyed Sidekick.
All right. Well, there you go.
Okay. I just got my copy of Weapon of God from Jimmy Robinson this week. I supported his Kickstarter, and it is really good.
All right, good stuff then. Let's move on then. We're going to open up with a book called Kiss Kids from IDW. Did all of us read this book, or is there anybody who didn't read this book? Everybody read this book.
I think we all read it.
I read this.
All right, good. The actual reason, though, we are reviewing it is not because all of us have read this, but because Chris described it as he wanted to take a big dump all over this book. So it's written by Chris Ryle and Tom Waltz. Art by Jose or Jose Holder, I'm not sure which. But anyways, Chris, you get to open then.
I like Chris Ryle actually a lot. However, his property work is getting more and more questionable. I did not enjoy seeing Kiss as little kids in full makeup. This is a programmer. They're just trying to do anything to keep Kiss in comic books. Let's have them cross with somebody. Let's have them fight Mars Attacks aliens or something. And this is just the next step in that gradual downward spiral that we've been traveling with Chris for Kiss for a long time. I did not enjoy this book. Do not support this book because the next step is Kiss meets Glee. I don't want that to exist. We have
to. They already met Archie.
Yes, I know this. This is
and now Archie's meeting Glee. So you know,
all I want is
wait,
somebody
two degrees,
to go.
2 degrees of
let's
Glee.
Make an awesome Kiss book.
An awesome Kiss book. That's
let's actually do this properly. Let's hire.
Angel Medina. Who wrote that one that Angel Medina drew that came out through McFarlane's imprint there?
Was it Brian Holguin?
Yeah. It's still, was it Psycho Circus? Was it any good?
You know, I didn't mind the first issue. Now, it's in my Kiss.
First issue. It went on about 50. But the first issue was pretty good.
It's in my Kiss compendium, my 40 pounds of Kiss comic books that I'll never read.
Neil Gaiman presents Kiss Kids. Yes, I want that, but not this.
Well, okay. Brett?
Hire somebody. Let's have a good Kiss comic book, and then we can go back to this crap.
Brett, as the biggest Kiss fan in the group, rebuttal?
I mean, I can never rebut a bad review of a Kiss comic book. I mean, there's never really been a really good Kiss comic book. And this is not a really good Kiss comic book. I think that Chris is being a tad stone-hearted with his review, because the fact is that it's cute, it's kind of funny. Now, I had a laugh when they bring Lil Demon his birthday present, and
that made me
what laugh. Does everybody bring him for his birthday present?
The thing
money.
He loves the most.
Yeah. Like,
everybody kept on describing, I got him the thing he loves the most. You can't. I brought him the thing he loves the most. Then you see it's just a big pile of money. That's,
you know, right
that
there.
Was perfect.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, hey, they got something right. It's not like it's the kind of book that I'm going to read on a regular basis, but it was kind of cute, and I wouldn't hesitate to put it in front of a child.
Okay. Other than that joke, this book sucked ass. Jose Holder, I think he's actually probably a fairly good artist. I get the feeling he might do some good work, but this is a book that talks down to the kids. It's presented towards, so it's not entertaining enough for adults, and it talks down to the kids, and it has a bunch of like little skits with the punchline being things like, oh man, don't go outside, it's gonna rain. But I brought my umbrella. And then they step outside, and the umbrella would have a hole in it, and they'd get wet anyways, and they'd just go, aw. And it's about that much inventiveness put into the effort of these punchlines. Like, just no effort whatsoever. Most of these jokes, I'm like, is that even a joke? Is that even funny?
It's the little rascals.
It's awful. It's awful. It's horrible dialogue, horrible little stories, just not funny, really just no effort.
Makes Family Circus look like Shakespeare.
Yeah, except for that one joke. Keith, final say on this. Is there anything left to be said?
I thought this was a really good Kiss comic.
I will agree with you. I haven't read a better one, I don't think.
The right way to say it is, well, I liked it.
I enjoyed this book. I thought it was cute. I mean, it's a little repetitive because it's, you know, each gag is only like 2 pages long, so it's kind of Archie style that way, that there's no substance to it at all. Oh, Archie's not funny.
He is.
I did in fact laugh out loud in the newspaper delivery 3-pager. I thought that was cute.
That was totally Archie. Like, I mean,
that was, what is it called? Spacey's for the Space Ace. Starshot is the only one they didn't have to change the name of.
Yeah.
And Little Demon. I thought it was cute. I thought it was fun, and it's every once in a while it's nice to have a lighter piece. I do wonder who the target audience is, because there's so many references to Kiss songs.
Oh yeah,
and they, of course the substance
guys
is incredibly
Kiss. The guys
young.
Who wrote it, they definitely know Kiss.
Well, Chris Riel writes the regular ongoing Kiss books plus the.
But here's the thing: if this is a Kiss book aimed for kids 8 years old and under, all four of them that are aware of who Kiss is will really enjoy this.
But I want action figures of all four of these kids. And
bam. And hey, if Gene Simmons has any say in the matter, you'll get them.
Indeed. I enjoyed it. I don't know if I need more of this. I think maybe one like one special or something was probably going to be as much as I wanted.
Yeah, you know,
I know the book will continue, but
yeah, one every 6 months would be great. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, about the level. I mean, it has about the same Q factor as the A Babies versus the X Babies.
I was going to ask, how does this compare to Little Gotham? Because that's really what it is.
It's just a little, good, right? You need to read Little Gotham if you think this.
Yeah, that's right. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the issue of Little Gotham. I
enjoyed this. Little Gotham is a work of genius. This was enjoyable.
Right. Well, I read the first Little Gotham, and I thought this was only slightly worse. All right. Keith, I think you get to go next then.
I get to go next. Yay. Let's talk about, what do I want to talk about next? How about let's talk about The Living Corpse Haunted.
What a name.
What a name indeed. What a name indeed. From the good people at Dynamite. This is several. We had three short stories. They're horror stories.
Two written by Ken Hauser, and he also did the story and art on one of them. The other one written by Keith Thomas with Blair Smith doing the art. So,
indeed, and I like the first story, the ghost story, and then the book just keeps going and going and going. I couldn't quite figure out what the Edgar Allan Poe story was supposed to be about, and I really, really didn't like Tears of the Clown, which is the third story in the book. It's a lot of the same thing. I don't think I could have read a whole issue of any of the stories, so that it was three short stories so that I only liked part of was probably better than if it had been one long story that I just didn't like any of. Not too interested to read more. The art didn't grab me. Coloring actually is the best thing I will say about this book. Blair Smith did all of the coloring, and I think that's probably the strongest part of the whole piece. The ghost effect in the first story, which is primarily done in color, was really kind of cool. I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Oh boy. Anytime you have an anthology that has several different stories in it, you're always wondering what you're going to get. This is just so strange. If the art's good, the writing is not good. If the writing and narrative are good, then the art sucks ass. Maybe you have a good concept here, but you don't have the skill to pull it off. Overall, this feels like just such an amateur's piece. If the best thing is passable and the rest isn't even that, then it's not worth purchasing.
All right. I actually think he said it all. I would not buy this book, but from what I've seen, and this is a rarity that it happens to me, that there is one standout thing in a book. Blair Smith, I actually think the one story he actually does the full art on, and as Keith said, the coloring is amazing. I'm going to keep an eye out for this guy to see what he does next.
What he does coloring on?
No.
Or he did the art on? Which one was that?
He did the art on The King and I, which I actually really enjoyed. And his coloring work is superb. So I'm actually looking forward to seeing what he does next.
As long as he colors it and doesn't write it, is that what you're saying? You actually like the art too.
I like the art on The King and I. I do. It's stylized, but I think it conveys emotion. The writing on the story could have been a hell of a lot better, but I enjoyed that type of art. It's not for everybody, but I'm looking forward to seeing what he does next. It was good enough for me to make a note of his name for future reference.
Well, I didn't think about the coloring when I was reading it, but I'll agree with you on that. I actually didn't like the first story, but got a couple of chuckles out of the second two stories. But that still wasn't enough for me to justify this as a winner. I would definitely say that it's a little too amateur hour for my taste, and in this case, just nothing we haven't seen before for the most part. Nothing special.
Brett, your turn again. Snake format.
All right. Well, why don't I grab hold of Miss Fury, the digital number one, or the number one for the... I don't even know what the hell the... Like, there seems to be too many Miss Fury books going on right now.
It says a Dynamite Digital First.
Yes, the Dynamite Digital First edition of Miss Fury. And so it was three stories, like three chapters in the book, which leads me to believe that it was a compiled digital story anyways. But I think...
That's what they meant by digital first.
Yep, there we go. Perfect. But, I think I had the same problem with this as I had with the Transformers monstrosity in that case, where it's just like you try to jam these stories together and they really don't flow very well as an issue. Now, in this case, I don't really give a rat's ass about the Miss Fury character to begin with, and the story was just completely, you'd pick up at some random point and I would feel completely lost for a little while. I'd pick it back up, go to another chapter, and the next thing you know, I'm lost again. So, and I just didn't like the art in the first one. It was a little too like Photoshop-y almost. So it just wasn't my cup of tea.
Chris?
I actually like this book. I haven't been cottoning on to any of the Dynamite superhero stuff. I know we have fans on this panel here, but really I've been overly positive on the whole thing. And this is the first time I actually got a sense of world building, that there's been past stories, there's future stories. And this is also the first time I felt that the character is more original. The Dynamite versions of Shadow and the Spider, I find them very similar, and I found Miss Fury actually more engaging, more original. I like the book. I might be picking this up for a lower price issue by issue and see how it goes, but it's a passable book. If I'm looking for something to read, I'd say pick it up. But is it a must-have? It definitely isn't a must-have.
All right, let's just bring it back here a little bit. This is written by Rob Williams. Illustrated, the first story, The Prelude, by Wagner Rees. Johnny Desjardins does chapter one, and Fritz Casis does chapter two, is the art on it. This story is certainly all around, all over the place. And it does have a certain sense of familiarity to it that I think all of these characters coming out of Dynamite, these pulpier characters of, I had a sense that I had read this before, except for they put it, her in such strange environments. And it had a little sense of fun to it, some humor in the dialogue that that kind of lightened it up a little bit. It's pretty good. I mean, I really liked the art that I liked was the first chapter, was The Prelude. I didn't like the others so much. It's not great. Like I say, it's a little familiar, but it's not bad. It is $3.99 and a hell of a lot of story for $3.99. You get a lot of book for your money here. So based on that, I would give it a slight recommendation. Keith?
Based on value, I'd say these as digital books were 99 cents. So it's only $2.97 to get them digitally. That said, I didn't really enjoy it. The first chapter, though it had the best arc, was also the most overwritten. There's not a square inch that they didn't jam another text box or a word balloon in. The action actually carries it quite well. They just won't shut up long enough for you to see much of it. It's another Dynamite book doing what Dynamite books do, and not too curious to read anymore.
Snake format, Keith, your turn.
All right, what do we got left to talk about? We got Army of Darkness versus Hack and Slash. Did anyone, who else read that?
I read that.
You read that?
Not me.
Yeah. Chris did.
Christopher did?
Yep.
Yeah.
Christopher woke up early to read that book. written by a friend of the show, Tim Seeley, who I talked to at Wizard World Chicago Comic Convention. And Hack and Slash just wrapped up its run. This is the next story, as he told us in the interview. Everything Hack and Slash is part of the same continuity. This isn't a side trip or anything. Art by Daniel Leister. Covers by Tim Seeley, Ben Templesmith, Ken Hauser, and Stefano Caselli. That's my best guess. I enjoyed the story. You don't need to know anything about Hack and Slash. I don't, and I still followed it without any problem. My only problem with this book was that Ash's dialogue was almost entirely lifted from the movies, and it didn't feel like more things the character would say. It felt like the same things he was saying again. It was a little like the lines, the kitschiness of the lines was a bit too familiar. I mean, that said, the character behaved within character. I haven't read any Army of Darkness comics, so I don't know how they handle that character in the comics. I only know him from the films. It was kind of enjoyable in a silly kind of way. As a film, it's a bit different than a regular film tie-in because it's really more focused on Hack Slash than it is on Ash. But it seems like it'll be an enjoyable romp. Lots of shooting, lots of possessed people that will get parts of their body shot. So I don't know. I think I'll read it. I may wait until it's collected or wait until it drops in price or whatever.
So Tim Seeley, who Keith talked to, as he mentioned, it was in our last show. He's interviewed with him, and he talked to him at the Wizard World Convention in Chicago. And as a friend of the show, has proceeded with this book to write a horrible comic book that is absolutely not worth anybody's time, terribly paced. The pacing is so far off, I can't even imagine it. The dialogue is awful from beginning to end on every character. The narrative, uh, it is forever. You say you don't need to know the characters. I think that's a load of crap. I've read a couple issues of Hack and Slash that helped me, and even then I was confused. A lot of that is that about 15 pages of action with absolutely no context as to who they are, where they are, and what's going on, even though it's referencing things that have happened in the past, occurs before he explains to us who these characters are. And by that point, it just feels really completely just thrown in there and shoved in there in a completely awkward way. The art is awful. Everything about this is just a complete waste of my time and everybody's time who's ever touched it. I've tried to read Hack and Slash before. It's not very good, but it wasn't awful. But this sure as hell was. Chris?
Everything Mo said, but the opposite. I like the book. What can you say? I actually hate Ash in the comic books. But here he felt like the movie Ash. I thought it was a great introduction point to Hack and Slash. I enjoyed it.
There's Hack in this book. Where's Slash?
Slash is dead. They tell you that.
They sort of mention it. It's sort of, I think, supposed to be a somber point. But it's still called Hack Slash. And we don't know. And they don't do a good job explaining that.
This character's dead.
That Slash one. And by the way, you never call him Slash, but we just assume he's Slash.
It's part of a larger arc.
I want to be specific that there's no character in this book called Army of Darkness either. And that is that wasn't a problem.
Not in this book, but there will be a character called Army of Darkness as a take on the Army of Darkness in the subsequent issues, Keith. Sucked. I guess that's how Army of Darkness will bring back this Slash character, who already is like a Frankenstein type, I guess. It's awful. Sorry, Keith. Chris, it's your review. What am I still talking for, saying how bad it was?
I have no idea. No, I enjoyed the art. Was it rewriting the Bible? No, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it as much as any other Hack and Slash.
Writing the Bible. Why can't we get that? That would be awesome. Keith, can you write it?
Can we review, like, there must be enough comics about religious stories that we can read. Like, there's the old Marvel one on the Pope. There's a couple of there's got to be a Classics Illustrated of the Bible. Are there enough of those that we can make an episode? There's the 185,000 page biography of the Buddha, but I don't know if we really want to get into that for the podcast.
Neil Gaiman rewrote the Screwtape Letters.
Yeah, okay. Right. Let's put that in the queue. Mm-hmm. Screwtape Letters is it's a work of
let's put it way far back in the queue. Brett, I really want you to read this book because these two liked it and I hated it so much. I really need somebody sane to tell me if I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
And yet I have to go to you, Brett.
Well, I'm not going to read it right now. You'll have to wait.
No? Are you sure you don't have the 37 seconds it'll take you to read it?
I'll let you know by next week what I thought.
I want to know by the morning. Brett, why don't you talk about a book that Keith didn't get around to, unfortunately, Bloodshot Zero.
Bloodshot Zero. Well, Matt Kent, it's always good to see Matt writing more comics. It seems to be he's writing a lot of comics right now. I thought this was a good Zero issue. It seemed very interesting. The most interesting element for me was the fact that I had just finished reading the Lost Symbol, The Last Symbol by Dan Brown, and it's actually about part of the story is about noetics, the noetic science, and the whole book, they're actually basically what Matt Kent is dealing with is noetic science and this concept in this case of the fact that there is a soul and that you can physically measure a human soul as the body dies. And I think the interesting thing is that in the background of one of the panels they have the weight, and the weight is actually the exact same as it is in the Dan Brown book. Whether it's like complete crackpotism or not, it doesn't necessarily matter. But yes, because
Keith says it is.
Because I'm...
Keith is nodding his head that it is.
Yeah. I'm not likely to believe it. But But I found it very interesting that, you know what, the thing about Noetic Science is it fits perfectly in comic books. And apparently Dan Brown novels too, but not that he's a good writer. Matt Kent is actually a better writer than Dan Brown, but I thought this was pretty good, and I did find it interesting that it had these ties to a book that I had just read.
Chris?
I love this book, man. It's got everything. It's got Bloodshot with a kick-ass afro. Only one panel,
for a panel,
it's there.
But it was definitely there.
Okay. Yeah, no, I love it. Actually, first Bloodshot comic book I really, really enjoyed. I liked that it was a true zero issue. It happened before any of the events in Bloodshot, giving us background into the characters, or character in this case, without infringing on the regular series. This is the perfect zero issue, and I truly enjoyed it. It was the best book of the week. The only thing I add, and that's just a little geeky note for me, is, you know, there could have been some sort of bizarre shout out to Ray in the Future Force, the book that originally spun Bloodshot out. Just a little in joke, but you know, that's minor. I definitely, this is the book of the week that you should spend money on.
Yeah, I mean. I agree with everything you say. This is pure Matt Kent. Chris agreed 100%. You said everything so perfectly, I'm not going to add to it, except for the Ray part. I'm glad they didn't do that. Keith?
Didn't read it.
Read it? I still have not read it.
That's right. Oh, that's right. No, that's too bad.
Is it Ray or Rye?
I would think Rye.
Actually, I have no idea.
It's actually Rye. Yeah. It is Rye.
Okay. Are you sure?
Rye and the Future Force? It is, well, when we interviewed Robert Venditti, he called it Rye.
Well, that's good enough for me.
Okay. We'll call him an expert. He works for the company, so I'll call him an expert.
Yeah. So, Keith, I guess all that's left to talk about is a couple books from Ugly Studios. Is that the name of the...
Ugly Studios Presents. These are a couple of independent. I know that's not how you pronounce it. books that got sent to us. They are anthology books. So Ugly Studios Presents, first story, Through the Eyes of Griselda, which is a story about a cat. And issue number one also has, I'm just looking at the preview copy here to jump ahead to the creator and to the second story here. The Great Vermin, Jason Lennox, David Paul writing, Jason Lennox doing pencils and inks on that story. Eyes of Griselda is story by Jason Lennox and David Paul, Jason Lennox on art. I liked Eyes of Griselda quite a bit. It's because I'm a cat person. I thought it was a cute story. The Great Vermin is a Twilight Zone story. It's whether that's something you like or something you don't like, it is very much a Twilight Zone story. It's only a six-page little bit. They're all kind of stories that would be right at home in Epic Illustrated back in the day. I found them interesting. They're pretty throwaway. I don't know if I would seek them out, but I'm glad I read them. The art is rough in places, very unpolished. There's some filler in the books, like some full page pentagrams, etc. I thought the story fit on Griselda more, just because it was more of a horror story, more of a rough edged classic story. But fun. I'm glad we got sent these. I got some enjoyment out of them.
I'm not going to be too rough on these guys because, I really appreciate something like this being sent to us. All of this, there's a couple stories where I'm like, the concept is so good and it was so close, but they're just not good enough artists, or they're just the dialogue isn't right, or they don't have the experience to pace it right. And every single storyline just fell a little short, and some of them fell quite a bit more short than others. But the thing is that what they're doing here is still important. It's people that love comic books, who are making comic books, who are gaining experience. The next great comic book artist or writer comes out of a book like this. In fact, very likely could come out of this book, even if it's not good yet. It's part of the experience and it's part of the process and it's important for the comic book community. So for that reason, it deserves your support, and you have to look at it in a different way. It's not good stuff necessarily, but it's important that these books exist. Chris?
How can you be so wrong on the other books reviewed this week and so right
like,
on
like
this one?
Like Bloodshot, where I talked about everything you said was right?
I was not referring specifically to Bloodshot. Okay. No, these Ugly Studios books, if you want to support independent artists, pick these up. But at the same time, I can't hold them next to something like Bloodshot Zero and say, spend your money on this and not Bloodshot Zero. If you want to support independent artists, definitely this is a good way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, that's the thing, is that there's some very good parts to some of these stories. I mean, I definitely like the Vermin story. I like the Twilight Zone episode as well. It all worked in that regard. It was just one of those cases where you find the things that you like, you enjoy those things, and you're happy about the fact that people are putting this work out there. So absolutely, for an independent book, these are fine. They're very good.
All right. So I think, Brett, why don't you do the plugs that are for the website and everything else this week? Why don't you go through it?
All right. Comics at wetalkpodcasts.com. Both would be plural, comics and podcasts. So anyways, I am Brett _ WeTalk. Do we still do the Comic Podcast Network? I don't remember.
Occasionally I throw it out there, but I'm not either way.
Excellent. So that's not very interesting there. From a personal standpoint, I will say that I just finished off a couple of numbers games for Comicosity, who we didn't mention before too much, but... the one on DC and the one on Marvel were the ones that I wrote.
All right. I'm Chris _WeTalk. Catch up with any of us on Twitter. We always enjoy it.
I am Cub Reporter K on Twitter. I just want to send out a thank you to Martin Dunn, who is the Chief Creative Officer of Con Artist Entertainment, which is a small publisher. Martin was so so upset by the news that Bleeding Ink, which we actually did talk about ages ago on the show, Bleeding Ink had several Kickstarters that they never fulfilled and have now wrapped up, had closed up shop, and will never fulfill their obligations on Kickstarter through many a story of woe that all involves him spending your money on something besides the product that he promised you. But Martin Dunn at Con Artist Entertainment has offered to give PDF copies of some of their comics to anyone who gave money to Bleeding Ink that never got anything. I did get some of those comics, and we're going to talk about them on the show here in another week or two, I think. This is some interesting stuff.
All right, and I'm Mo at WeTalk, or Mo _WeTalk. That would be where you'd get me on the Twitter. I think that's it. So thanks to everybody for listening to our thousands
we'll throw one last thank you out to the Guzzo brothers for making Who Is Delson and sending it to us.
And again, to show sponsor Comicosity as well. So let's go out, everybody, by doing the Barbershop Quartet, but this time saying goodbye. So goodbye.
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 Bye.
Oh, Chris. Let's do it one more time, this time saying O-U-T. O-U-T.
O-U-T.
O-U-T.
O-U-T.
Beautiful. O-U-T, guys.
I was afraid I was going to spell it wrong.